teachers don't want to be competing with the dings or the buzzes or the other things when your phone's on. And as a district, we want to be supportive.
Schools across North Carolina are banning cell phones in the classroom to comply with a new state ban. Welcome to Carolina Connection. I'm Maddie Policastro.
And I'm Raina Drake. Also this week, UNC student organizations adjust to tighter budgets. It's muscadine season, and we step through a local farm for a history of our state fruit. And the North Carolina Folk Festival uses music to send a message about community.
Folk music just reminds us that we're people, and remember that some of the struggles that we're having now, we've always had, and the proverbial we will get through this as well.
From the UNC Hussman School of Journalism and Media, this is Carolina Connection.
Thank you for joining us. In North Carolina public schools, some teachers are celebrating, but many students are feeling disconnected. That's because of a new state law that restricts cell phones in the classroom. The law takes effect in January, but many school systems have already banned them. As Carolina Connections' Rachel Moody reports, the ban looks different from school to school.
Most school districts have already begun implementing their own policies. Schools like Green Hope High School in Cary started banning phones in the classroom last year.
It only started my junior year, so last year, and they just had us put our phones up for every class, just like in a phone pocket up at the front of the classroom.
Sedasi Shah, a senior at Green Hope High School, says some students are trying to find ways around the ban.
When the bell rings, like, the teacher will be like, now put your phones up. Like, don't, like, put up a fake phone or something, because that's become, like, really common, where they put, like, an old iPhone that they have at home instead of, like, their actual phones.
The new law leaves much for interpretation, leading to variation among different districts and charter schools. Green Hope's policy bans phones during class periods, but allows students to use them during class transitions and lunch. On the other hand, Chapel Hill-Carlborough City Schools prohibits devices even during transitions, and it also bans smartwatches and Bluetooth headphones. But at after-school events like this varsity volleyball game, staff and students are free to use their devices openly.
Are we up?
No.
Matt Dixon, Chapel Hill High School's athletic director, sells electronic tickets at a table outside the auxiliary gym. He says the phone ban is going well.
Kids have been really resilient and learned quickly, and the instructional time is being met.
Teachers don't want to be competing with the dings or the buzzes or the other things that you can pay attention to when your phone's on. And as a district, we want to be supportive of that.
Chapel Hill Carlborough City Schools Chief Communication Officer, Andy Jenks.
So far, I think the response has been positive, particularly from our teacher and parent community. I think depending on how many students you ask, you might get a different opinion of that.
Just an 11-minute drive away from Chapel Hill High School, student teacher Rin Young has witnessed some of the unintended effects of the policy. Young graduated from UNC a few months ago and is now studying to get their Master's of Arts in Teaching at UNC. Peabody Hall is home to the School of Education.
And then if we turn right here, I've had like 5 classes in here. Yeah, so it's definitely been a home for me, away from home.
A few weeks ago, Young started working as a student teaching assistant at East Chapel Hill High School. They help teach chemistry to 10th, 11th, and 12th graders alongside their teacher mentor.
There's different programs and things that are like on a phone that like your Chromebook can't necessarily do as easily.
Students are still allowed to use school-issued Chromebooks in class.
We were doing a lab and they had to time, and it really depended on them to look at the computer that was on the screen up in the front and make sure that they were doing it on time, and they were having to like swivel and like pivot every like 30 seconds and make sure that everything was lined up instead of having like a stopwatch just like on their phone. And they can use their computers, but it's again like it's a convenience thing because so many people are like, oh yeah, I can just pull it up on my phone.
The responsibility to enforce the policy falls largely onto teachers like Young's clinical educator.
And I've already seen people like have it in their pockets and like it fall out, and my CE is like, you have to put that away. Like if administration walks in here, like we're both gonna get in trouble.
There are a few more months for schools to work out the kinks in their policies until the law becomes effective in January. In Chapel Hill, I'm Rachel Moody.
University leaders this week updated the campus community on UNC's uncertain budget situation. Vice Chancellor Nathan Nuffman said federal budget cuts may not be as severe as some have feared, but reductions are still likely. One way UNC hopes to save money is by starting an incentive program for employees to retire.
A big update is the system has granted us authority recently in the last 2 weeks to be able to move forward with a program in this space. A lot of questions around who's eligible, staff, faculty, we're still working through that in timing, so we're still working through that, but we'll be following up with more details.
Meanwhile, Nuffman said UNC will reduce financial aid for non-residents by $17 million.
That's going to occur over 4 years. That's a reduction in aid budget allocated to non-residents to really align that percentage to match their proportion of the student body population. I think importantly, it does not impact current students. And other important aid sources remain unimpacted.
While a lot of questions are still unanswered, Chancellor Lee Roberts said his mission is the success of the research and teaching at Carolina.
Many student organizations at UNC have less money to spend this semester than they've had in previous years. But it's not because of federal or state budget cuts. It's because UNC has adopted new accounting methods for distributing the funds. The tighter budget means fewer resources for events, outreach, and student support. Brooks Stevenson reports.
1, 2, 3, 4.
In a classroom, members of the UNC walk-ons rehearse. They're honing in on their songs as they prepare for their fall concert. A well-known a cappella group here at UNC, the walk-ons are facing a reduction of about half of their funding when compared with last year. That money supports vital functions, such as recruitment and reserving venues for concerts. Treasurer Sam Leggett says the cut will significantly limit what the group can do during the fall semester.
So it basically removes the possibility of doing any other projects, like recording songs to put on Spotify or entering the ICCA contest without going into our savings.
For Leggett, the walk-ons are a vital way to engage with peers outside an academic environment.
Since I've been in the walk-ons, I've had better academic performance because I have an outlet for creative expression. I have other responsibilities than what I'm doing for school.
And the walk-ons are not the only ones experiencing these cuts. The National Alliance on Mental Illness's UNC chapter was allocated $2,700. Last fall, they got $3,400. In Davis Library, packed with students working, NAMI UNC's treasurer, Abigail Hibbler, says the organization's new budget will lead to a lot of restructuring.
We need to be able to look at if we want to allocate the money for supplies specifically or which kind of events we think are going to take up the most amount of the money.
The Undergraduate Senate allocates funding for student organizations. The money allocated to student organizations comes from the undergraduate student fees. In August, the Undergraduate Senate lowered the maximum funding that groups can ask for, from $10,000 to $5,000. The chair of the Senate's Finance and Appropriations Committee, Nyan Bala, says the goal is to lower the funding expectations of student groups.
That's kind of why we made that decision to move it down to five, is to make sure that organizations' expectations were a bit more realistic through keeping less of a disparity. You have a higher percentage of your request being funded.
For this school year, the total amount of money available to student organizations is about the same as last year. What's different is how the money is divided. Student Affairs authorized about 3/4 of it for the fall and only 1/4 of it for the spring. That change has made this fall's budget cycle more competitive for student organizations applying for funding. UNC Media Relations states that, quote, "This change in the allocation process has been made to align with sound accounting practices. There has been no reduction in funding for student organizations, nor is this process change related to changes in federal or state funding for the university." Student organizations are continuing to look for other avenues to ease the limits on their budgets. Hibbler says UNC NAMI's leadership is set on finding other sources of funding to further their organization's goals.
I know that there's a grant for North Carolina NAMI that we've applied to in the past, so I assume that that's going to be something that our presidents are going to talk about to look into applying for that.
The UNC walk-ons are also finding other ways to react to their financial situation. Leggett says this group has options to make up for their limited budget.
We're putting a heavy focus on fundraising, so we are collaborating with this company called Eats to Seats, which will let us sell concessions at football games and use that as an avenue for fundraising.
Student organizations across UNC's campus are adapting to this new change and hope there will be more opportunities for funding as the semester continues. In Chapel Hill, I'm Brooke Stevenson.
You're listening to Carolina Connection, the weekly student newscast from the UNC Hussman School of Journalism and Media. I'm Maddie Pellicastro.
And I'm Raina Drake. This year, the annual North Carolina Folk Festival in Greensboro was not only a celebration of music. The Southern and international voices called communities together, using their songs to call for action and love during times of division. Carolina Connection's Liani Riyashi was there.
Elizabeth Cotton was known for her unique left-handed guitar and banjo method, which today is known as Cotton style. Her original lyrics, produced from the age of 10, have been covered by the likes of Bob Dylan, Joan Baez, and the Grateful Dead. She last performed at 94 years old.
She said to them, "This may be the last time I perform with you all because I'm 94 years old and I'm not feeling well."
Brenda Evans is the great-granddaughter of Elizabeth Cotton and performed Shake Sugaree with the Steep Canyon Rangers, which she originally performed in 1967 at 12 years old. After she sang on Sunday, Evans asked the crowd to choose love.
She said, "I love each and every one of you." She said, "Please love one another."
This wasn't the only call to action at the North Carolina Folk Festival, with just about every act taking the time out of their set to comment on topics including keeping public radio safe and protecting abortion as healthcare.
So my message was to the Latino people, but not only to them, but also people who were attending, that I was making a call to make sure that they are checking on people that they may know.
Maria Gonzalez, originally from Medellin, Colombia, has called Greensboro home for over 20 years. The former board chair of the festival, she now hosts La Gozadera, a pop-up Latin dance party open to the entire community. This year at the festival, she taught a beginner's merengue class.
So remember that step that we did, side to side, we can do that here too.
People are dancing, singing things that they don't even understand. Children are holding hands, and now more than ever, we need to find ways of connecting people, and I find that art, music, dance does that.
Denisha is a country and Americana singer from Southeast Texas. Her song, All the Sweet Tea, is a testament to her love for North Carolina and highlights the representation of Southern American folk music that sounds through the festival each year. She believes the characteristic storytelling of the genre is a great way to get people to talk and listen to one another.
I meet people who may not agree with everything that I believe in. I might not agree with everything they believe in, but I find that people are largely good. And that comes from in-person interactions. That comes from putting the phone down. Folk music just reminds us that we're people, and remember that some of the struggles that we're having now, we've always had, and the proverbial we will get through this as well.
From the streets of Greensboro to her roots in Carrboro, Elizabeth Cotton's legacy lives on, not just in the songs she left behind, but in the hands, voices, and hearts of a new generation. In Greensboro, I'm Liana Rieschi.
There are no punches thrown in the Royale, the current show at Playmakers Repertory Company. But make no mistake, there's still a fight on stage. Inspired by the life of boxer Jack Johnson, the Royale tackles racial injustice and the cost of winning. Gracie Durham talks with the actors and the creative team behind this thought-provoking performance.
In The Royale, Galen Ryan Kane plays a boxer named Jay the Sport Jackson. It's loosely based on the life of Jack Johnson, the first black heavyweight champion of the world in 1908. The play follows the social tensions as Jay steps into the ring to fight a white opponent.
And now, the fight you came for. Boom. Ladies and gentlemen, the fight you paid your hard-earned dreams.
Kane says the story is about more than a boxing match.
There's a lot of pressure and tension that he's carrying because he's on a rigorous journey, not just to fight for a title, but to fight for a place where he feels like he belongs, in a place that tells him, we don't want you here.
Jay's journey is supported by Fish, played by Zach Bazile.
His real name is Pearly Fish Hawkins. They took him on tour, and he's preparing Jay for his fight against the big fight of his life.
Kane says he and Bazile needed to be in sync to bring their roles to life.
There are moments where I can't see what Zach is doing, but we had to build a language, that a gesture that is in sync with his movement, and like vice versa.
This synchronicity is essential to the style of the Royale. While the play is about boxing, no actual punches are thrown. Instead, actors use movement and rhythm to emulate the feeling of a fight.
The challenge was, how are we going to communicate and teach the audience the language of fighting, not just physically, but also the writer Marco was fighting in the minds.
We're not physically showing punches, but through our feet, through our hands, through our sounds that our body makes, we called it like a body percussion, those emulate punches or like physical like contacts.
I think what he's noting on is that this entire metaphor of boxing is psychological.
Creating a psychological fight requires coordination between actors and the technical crew. Laura Pates, the technical director, knows how much the details matter in transporting an audience into a story.
And I mean, we'd spend, 4 hours on a short sequence easily, and then have to like, boom, do it, and it would be maybe a minute long.
Pates says the absence of actual punches allows the story's emotional weight to be prioritized.
All these different characters have something different that they're fighting for. I think if you asked each one of those characters, what does winning mean, it would be different. And so to put a literal fight on stage would take away from the thought-provoking aspect of it.
The Royale is not only thought-provoking for the audience, it also prompted questions for Kane himself about the costs of success as a Black man in America.
One question that comes up throughout this process was, are my fellow Americans afraid to see me succeed? Does my success spark or incite fear and hatred in others?
Bazile agrees that those questions are just as relevant today.
I always think of it as the cost of winning, the cost of being ambitious, and what are the consequences or the repercussions that come after it. I mean, one thing we gotta remember, this is of course like a period piece, but a lot of these issues that were faced back in those days, we're still seeing, in today's time.
Kane builds on that, saying he hopes audience members come away with a gained understanding of the cost and courage that it takes to break boundaries.
It's an internal struggle that hopefully in the play you see that cost of it, but also the gain of it. Hopefully audience members leave with understanding what was gained from that.
Tickets are available to see the Royale at Playmakers Repertory Company through the 28th of September. In Chapel Hill, I'm Gracie Durham.
Traditions are known for being passed down through the grapevine. However, the legacy of muscadine grapes, our state fruit, may be fading away. Emmy Berger takes us to a local farm for a lesson on muscadines and what they mean for North Carolina culture.
Just off Massey Chapel Road, away from the bustling shops and honking cars at South Point Mall, lies a farm holding onto a precious but disappearing Southern delicacy. Mother and son Phyllis Hicks and Jason Strauss consider themselves longtime lovers of the muscadine grape.
One of my favorite memories is my son here, Jason. When he was young, he and my father, his grandfather, had a very close relationship. And my dad used to take him out in his arms, and they would stand under the grapevine and pick grapes.
I moved down the vine with them at Herndon Hills Farm, watching them carefully inspect each grape and plop them into their buckets.
Quite right.
Yeah, a lot of these aren't quite right. They're getting there.
There are different varieties and that ripen at different times, so you have to really test and be sure. Oh, like this one right here is soft. Do you want to taste it?
I would love to. Thank you.
Yeah.
That's delicious.
Isn't that good?
Nancy Herndon, owner of the over 200 years old Herndon Hills Farm, has her own method for picking just the right grape. And she knows a thing or two about muscadines, with the farm growing 10 different varieties every year, all organic and sold pick-your-own style.
Pick the ones that feel soft and juicy, because the juiciness is the main thing about the muscadines.
The muscadine, North Carolina's official state fruit, was first documented by Sir Walter Raleigh in 1584 and described as being on the sand and on the green soil, on the hills as on the plains, as well as on every little shrub. Muscadines are very difficult to sell commercially, with easily bruised skin and a short shelf life, meaning small farms in the South are often your best bet. Southern food writer and star of PBSNC's The Key Ingredient, Sherry Castle, hopes they won't disappear completely.
When you have these very specific native things, fruits and vegetables and plants go extinct just like other things do, and extinct is gone.
The oldest cultivated grapevine in North America, known as the mother vine, once sprawling across 2 acres on Roanoke Island, now takes up about a third of a residential backyard. The mother vine is where a majority of all living muscadine vines are derived, holding a distinctive sweetness and musky flavor that is difficult to recreate in modern varieties. With the recent chemical spray, the mother vine is far from its former glory.
We just about lost the mother vine several years ago. It got sprayed with a defoliant from a utility company, and they had to bring in viticulture experts from around the world to save what's left of it.
North Carolina culture is deeply entrenched in food. And yet, an ancient and beloved fruit that has survived centuries is now few and far between.
Most people have never heard of the mother vine. And I mean, think about that. That is such an incredible thing that North Carolina gets to claim.
The muscadine remains a tradition held dear by those who have heard of it. Memories based in the old teaching the young to suck the sweet juice from those tough purple skins. Jason Strauss and his mother plan to return to Herndon every September as long as they can, with Jason using his tried and true picking technique.
The best way to know if it's ripe or not is to just take one off the vine and taste it.
In Durham, I'm Emmy Berger.
Finally, how old is too old to run your first triathlon? Well, according to the beginner-friendly triathlon, She Tries, the answer is never. Rachel Moody takes us to the finish line.
She Tries returned to Chapel Hill for the second year, encouraging women of all ages and experience levels to get outside and move. About half the participants are between 30 and 49 years old, but the rest range between the ages of 11 and 80.
I am Angie Click, and I am one of the owners and the founder of She Tries, and my title is Champion of Confidence.
Click founded She Tries in 2015, and Sarah Hayes joined as her business partner in 2018.
I put this here for the shirts.
Yeah.
We can grab one more table.
Click, Hayes, and Chapel Hill organizer Jill Adelson are setting up outside UNC Wellness Center the day before the event.
A lot of times when you're raising kids, you turn into your kid's life. And I think that's great, but I also think you really, really need your own thing, too. With these shorter distances, you know, usually you can get up before the kids get up and get a run in.
Click is a mom to 3 girls.
What's been my signature tagline since the beginning is really, and I say this at every start line, is just inhale confidence and exhale doubt.
Over 200 women and girls cluster near the start line. Some wear special tri-suits and swim caps, others don sports bras, one-piece swimsuits, and goggles.
I'm feeling nervous and a little bit cold, but excited.
Allison Blotzer, a 42-year-old from D.C., waits near the back of the crowd.
But I do this with my mom, who's 80, and I'm doing it with my daughter, who's 13, and so it's a fun way for us to get together and, I don't know, do something fun.
Allison Blotzer's mother, Linda Blotzer, is the oldest person in today's event. The event kicks off with a 250-yard swim at UNC Wellness Center's indoor pool. From the pool, participants head back outside towards their shoes and bikes and join the cars on Meadowmont Lane for a 9-mile ride.
Whoa, it's cold.
The event ends with a 2-mile run before crossing the finish line.
I know running without the stroller postpartum, I could probably
do it like a 9-minute mile, but I wanted to do it with my son.
Serena Roland's son is only 2 months old.
So I signed up again this year once I was cleared for my doctor to run postpartum.
This is Roland's second triathlon, but she has experience running marathons and 10Ks.
I really think this is a very positive environment. It makes women who don't feel like they can do actual things, like Ironmans, local triathlons, and things like that, this event gets women into that field without feeling like they actually have to compete. They can just come out here and do it for fun.
Nice work.
I wanted to thank you because when I saw you running, your form reminded me to stand up.
Oh, really? Hey, if I can help anybody, it's my pleasure.
Thank you.
Well, seeing you in front of me encouraged me. I was struggling when I...
Cheryl Boyland, a 54-year-old from Cary, did the alternative duathlon option. Duathlons only include running and cycling, no swimming.
Been there, I've done probably 30 duathlons. I've never done a race where it's just women, and it feels so different. All the warm and fuzzy feelings are there. Everybody was out there encouraging each other. When I could breathe, I was trying to encourage others.
Boylan says the environment is hyper-positive compared to mixed-gender races. In Chapel Hill, I'm Rachel Moody.
Thank you for listening to Carolina Connection. We are a production of the UNC Hussman School of Journalism and Media. We hope you enjoyed your time with us. Our technical directors are Kevin Paris and Kalias Galbraith-Fau DeCanto. I'm Raina Drake.
And I'm Maddie Policastro. There's more to be discovered at carolinaconnection.org. You can also find our stories on Instagram, Facebook, Blue Sky, or wherever you get your podcasts. Now back to weekend programming on 97.9 The Hill.